You're listening to a Cripple and Co. production.
Welcome to A.G. Parker's Cabinet of Curiosities, an inclusive podcast focused on queer, disabled and marginalised artists and their art. You can support the podcast by signing up to Patreon. And oh my God, guess what? There's a new Patreon tier. You can also buy me a coffee on Buy Me a Coffee, which you can find on my link tree. And now, on with the show. Today on the podcast, I've got Anna Rose James, who is a queer bisexual actor, writer of poetry, flash fiction, autofiction, screenplays and scripts, co-founder of Sonnet Sisters, Six Lips Theatre and The Podvangelist, and the voice of 3CCO in Tin Can Podcast. She reviews theatre for Arts York and speculative fiction for Horror Tree Press and slash reads weird short fiction for The Drabblecast. Her published work includes Unknown by Stairwell Books and Little Irritants, Analog Submission Press, and 100 Friggin' Poems. Anna Rose, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. The sun's peeking out in Yorkshire for the first time in a while.
Oh God, I love Yorkshire.
Yeah, it's very pretty.
Very pretty, but it can get extremely cold this time of year, so it's nice to be cosied up inside doing a podcast.
Yeah.
So you have quite a lot of hats. You do quite a lot of different things. Talk to us a little bit about everything that you do.
I typical Gemini, I guess. I just love a bit of everything and feel like I've had many different lifetimes, and it's really nice kind of just swimming in and out of each of them. One of the things that's both like enables that and makes it difficult is maintaining a day job. So like I work full time in a day job and try to fit everything else creative around that, partly because it keeps me sane and it also gives me material. It also just, I don't know, makes me feel a bit more rounded and whole, and gives me a bit of space to think, because when you're working in the arts, it can get very you form a lot of like intensive relationships to either your work or people that you're working with, and each sort of project, a lot of the stuff I do is project based, can feel like a bit of a flash in the pan, and then you have a bit of a burnout from it and have to recover and then come back, which I'm sure has lots more reasons to it than just it being creative work. But it takes a little bit of, if you're passionate about something and you're putting your whole self into it, it can use up some spoons.
Oh definitely.
I think the writing, literature and storytelling, as stories have always been a big part of my life. I think from when I was little, I was dissatisfied with the endings of lots of things and just wanted to retell them in my own way.
Such a fantastic reason to become a writer. I love that.
Inspired by bad writing. Lots of people are like, oh, read this, it's amazing, it's got beautiful language, and that's one of my biggest influences. And I read this stuff and I'm like, I can't ever write anything ever again, because what's the point? It's some of it can be quite overwhelming, but yeah, I love that liminal space of like giving yourself room to be bored and just leaning into that, I guess, because when you need your brain to have a little bit of off time between being stimulated or being wowed by things to dream up your own stuff.
Oh, definitely. I know, a lot of people get their ideas in the shower or when walking the dog. And I know, like, for me, yeah, walking the dog or going to the gym, and I'm kind of, you're like rushing out of a gym session thinking, I must write this down.
Yeah, yeah. So the notes app on my phone is my best friend. I mean, there's always been this like, snobbery about, oh, how can you possibly write things on your phone or digitally in any way? It's the time.
Oh my God, no.
Yeah, I'm not going to carry around a big notebook.
My notes app is everything. Like, that's where I put so many of my ideas. I did used to record stuff because somebody said, oh my God, like record stuff on a little recorder and that'll be so much more easier. It's going to revolutionize, everything. I can't do it. It's like you listen
back to
it.
Back or
it's,
what?
Part of it is the listening back, and you're like, "What garbage was I? was I trying to say?" I find it easier to write stuff than
yeah.
say stuff. It's like a different way that my brain works, I think.
Me too. I'm constantly saying in the day job, "Oh, let me just do this myself for a sec in the background because I think with my fingers," and it's
yeah.
so true. I can't. I think writing definitely. Maybe this is about something to do with how my brain works, but writing has always given me a bit more of a voice than I feel I have in the flesh, if you like, because sure, like talking through an idea also gives you a little bit of a tool to help it settle or to form, but writing it just felt like so much more satisfying and more, I don't know, I think it gave me this sense of agency, because in words I really find that sense of power of being able to articulate exactly what I mean in my own time, in my, you know, my space, and then you can present it, which is not a very social version of conversing or, you know, having contributing to a discourse, but, you know, it's nice to have both.
Sure, it's really comforting to hear somebody else feel that way, because I know I speak to a lot of people who are like, I really want to, you know, like communicate, or, you know, it is more about kind of like the in-person like speaking element a lot of the time, like or storytelling, and I find it very hard to process things that way. So I've got, you know, all sort of mobility issues, so I've got stuff like voice to text software, which is meant to be really helpful, and it's not because the process for me is really hard. I need to write it down, and then it feels like my mind is quiet when I'm typing. I don't know if that makes any
yeah absolutely, because when I'm talking I'm having to think about talking and how I'm sounding, and I'm hearing myself back. I think yeah, audio particularly is very, I'm very sensitive to audio stimulus, and I mean, yeah, it's difficult to pass out really, because like visual stuff I find really inspiring and engaging, but audio feels like a real invasion almost. It feels like a more than a joy, it can feel like a distraction or a harm, like because of the way that I process stuff. So yeah, I think I've never really thought about it that way, but I think when I'm talking, because I'm hearing me, it's all those layers of no. Yeah,
I completely understand that. It's very interesting to speak to somebody with a similar experience. How wonderful. And it's, thank you so much even more for coming on the podcast and doing this thing, which could be quite difficult.
Yeah, conversely, love podcasts. Don't know how that works, but here we go.
The human brain is super interesting. So you wanted to talk a little bit about language and etymology.
Yeah, it's just so obviously, like you said, I wear a lot of different hats. So I consider myself a sort of Jane of all trades and, you know, master of none. And a lot of what I do is just out of being an interested party, really, and loving language, loving I just love life, really. And the etymology, I guess, is, I'm really interested in the significance of how language lands, and context is another key part of how my brain works. Like, I need to understand the why of something to actually, I think it's a motivational thing. So I find it really hard to do something if I don't have a why. And finding out the sort of the progression of a word through history is so interesting to me, and making those little connections helped me kind of understand the emotional impact of a word, I guess, which in poetry or in storytelling, in acting, it gives you that that weight, which can be missing. And I have like a bit of a love-hate relationship with acting in general, like as an industry, but as a practice, I know there are lots of things that are required in performance to make something watchable. But I'm so much more interested in the going through, I guess, the rehearsal process and the workshopping and all that side of it than the performance, because it's so much more about exploring emotions for me and like finding finding emotional truth and it just exploring corners of human experience, I think. And language and etymology feels like the thread of history or the tool that enables me to do that. It feels like my sort of way into human experience. Makes me sound like an alien. But
no, I think that's a beautiful way of looking at it. And I think a lot of people who are sort of who exist within the margins, especially within the arts, they do use it as a way of kind of processing or relating to or feeling included as part of, you know, as part of the world. So I think, and especially with writing, and I can imagine acting as well, you've got different people's interpretations of a, you know, a series of words that are written on a page. So that must be really, you know, vast in terms of how people, you know, come out with different performances.
Oh, absolutely. There's a fascinating book by I have to remember her real name because I always call her Harriet Bay, because a friend of mine and I went to London to see her in this show that just like blew our minds. But Harriet Walter or Walters was in this all female Shakespeare trilogy at the Donmar Warehouse at King's Cross. And it was just, I don't ever really get to see theatre on that kind of scale. And it properly threw me back in love with it. So she wrote a book called Brutus and Other Heroines about her experiences of acting various roles in Shakespeare. And it was just such a joy to read because it was full of that stuff. It was full of accounts of, you know, I played this against so-and-so and one night he did this. And then the next night it was slightly different because the audience reacted like this. And so we adjusted this a bit and it meant that this line brought out this meaning. I was like, oh, this is why I love theatre. It's so great.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so dynamic and fascinating. And it changes, as you say, with every like audience member or with every kind of slight nuance on different words, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shakespeare's a really good one for that as well.
I think I got to study the boring plays in school. I only really remember like Romeo and Juliet was the first one they taught us, and I was like, yeah, this is a boring, like who wants to think of undying love at the age of 12, 13, 14, and be like, everyone dies and is awful, and this is so like manipulative and
toxic,
you know, it's just wrong. It's all it's so bad. Messaging not so great, but and then I think Twelfth Night was the one that sort of more appealed to me when I read that in college, because A, gender fuckery, B, everybody is bisexual. It's just, there's a lot wrong with it. There's a lot wrong with all of them, but that felt like, nothing is set in stone. And also the poetry is gorgeous. There's so many ways you can play all the different attractions between different pairs of characters, and whether they actually really like each other, whether they're teasing or trying to get away from each other, or being a bit coercive, or like a prat in love, because, you know, hilarious comedy if people are so desperately in love that they're trying to force the object of their affection to return it. And Viola's build me a willow cabin at your gate speech is just if you're saying this to someone that you don't love and you're not trying to woo for yourself, but mate, like, try harder to be not attractive, because that's One of the highest expressions of love I've ever heard. It's so committed to the bit, you know?
Yeah,
It's just
be
wild.
less attractive, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. No, I'm definitely here for queer Shakespeare. That's some really good, really good things going on in the theatre at the moment, kind of looking back at older plays at Shakespeare and kind of doing a lot of gender fuckery in general across the board for like traditional plays, which is it's amazing. And I think of the youth of today who maybe just won't grow up with Romeo and Juliet and then Wuthering Heights, although I love Wuthering Heights. But all these
I
kind of,
that's such a an intense book.
yeah.
I read that for, well, I supposedly read it for my degree, and then listened to an audiobook of it, and wow, that really sent home the book to me, because it was so nasty. Everyone in the book was so foul, and I don't nobody really talks about how horrible it is.
But this is it, like you were saying, I can't believe, like, as at t at sorry, at school, like, the first thing that we're introduced to of Shakespeare's is Romeo and Juliet. But similarly, I remember sitting there reading Wuthering Heights in class being like, this is some fucked up shit. Like, how are these kind of not our role models necessarily, but like all of these different views of the world that we're being given because it's traditional literature that's held up or put on a pedestal. But I feel like there could be a little bit more consideration about the impact. I think reading Wuthering Heights so obsessively as a teen had an impact on how I see the world and maybe how I navigate relationships. But yeah, how about you?
100%.
Yeah.
And it's they forget, well, not forget, but I really don't know what the sort of master plan is about this, if there is one. But in education, they hold up these traditional texts as, this is important because it has survived the test of time, and it was a revolutionary work at the time. Yeah, people hated it because it shook them to their core, because it's foul. They don't really. They sort of gloss over that fact, or it's like a little curious, amusement about something that it really upset people at the time, and there's good reasons. And yeah, it is wild that it doesn't come, it's not presented to younger people with huge caveats of, this is not love, by the way. This is not healthy romantic behavior. This is romance with an R. It doesn't make
Yeah.
it, lovely.
No, definitely do not idealize this and end up in a relationship with somebody who is very similar to Heathcliff. So speaking of upsetting and very toxic toxic things to read, trigger warnings or content warnings. Let's get into that.
This is a hill that I'll die on, I guess. I'm fascinated by, and is that the right word? Yeah. I'm fascinated by the discourse around content warnings, as and obviously it has an impact that I have some skin in the game. I have things that do trigger me, and I think most of the discourse around them doesn't. I'm yet to hear a convincing argument against content warnings, because it all seems to come from a point of not really understanding what they are in the first place, or the actual need for them. And it's just a real shame. We had a much better understanding, I think, of PTSD post world wars, and we should have a much better, more empathetic understanding of that these days. But everything seems to be a lot more divisive and dichotomous these days.
That you're
So
either a snowflake or you just get on with it because you're not a snowflake.
exactly, the just get on with it. That really hurts to hear that from, especially from the mouths of other people with any aspect of their identity that's marginalized or that has been oppressed or harmed by non-marginalized people or structures. And I'm seeing, like, I have one big example in my head that really I was just not okay with. And it was this famous actress talking about sexual violence within marriage in her generation. I can't even remember what decade she was talking about. But she said something along the lines of, you just got on with it in those days. That's just what happened. And that is so sad for her. And so a lot of people's response to content warnings is, oh, come on now, just get on with it. And like, mate, I would love to just get on with it. And they don't understand that it's not a choice. It's not a, it's just a continuation of this weird stigmatization of mental health as if it is separate from physical health. And that's another wild thing. The brain is in the body, the brain is in charge of the whole shebang. So it's like just like being sick in your foot or your bumhole, you're gonna get sick in your brain sometimes.
And
And
it should be, like you get warnings for flashing lights during performances.
yes,
It's
exactly.
exactly the same as that.
And
It's
people
going to
get
trigger.
so embarrassed when they feel that they've got it wrong or that they've been, told off. I think that's one thing we could really learn to deal with better is I don't remember really, outside of my family anyway, and I don't think my family were experts at this either, but we don't really get taught how to process guilt or shame or embarrassment, just like move through making mistakes, other than, it's quite a punitive, in my experience anyway, which is mostly like in the UK and at home, and in society, I guess. But yeah, people do not like to be told they've made a mistake. And also, there are plenty of times where it's not a mistake, it's just, you read something and that didn't trigger you necessarily, and so you didn't think to mention, oh, by the way, this includes blah. But it just feels like such a really basic level of care, like a duty of care to people. If you're recommending things to friends, or if you're, trying to sell your own work, do you want people to read it again? Do you want people to come back and be repeat customers, or do you want to maintain that friendship? Or are you just trying to shout into what, like, why are you telling people this if you don't want to connect on some level with them? So
Well,
that
that's
it
interesting.
feels.
I do think that I've like from what I was have observed. Sorry, my jaw is coming out. I think that there's sometimes a distinction between people who do art because they want to, like shout, and kind of just make some noise, and there's people who genuinely want to connect and to form a relationship with the audience or to have an impact or to build a community. And I think those people are often quite open to hearing things about, actually, it would be nicer if you put a content warning before your poem that you do on the open mic. Not that we were both present recently at a night where that happened, and oh my God.
Oh boy. It makes me sad that people would rather further people suffer what they have suffered because they want to protect their own pride, or they want to forget what's happened to them. I don't know. I don't know what the reasoning is, but it seems to be connected to only shame,
I
and
think
self-preservation.
sometimes the reason is, oh, I don't want to put a trigger warning in because then it'll give clues as to what's coming up and it's going to lessen the impact or the shock won't be there. And I think in some ways I can almost see that, point, because if you read something like, oh, violence, trigger warning violence, you're thinking, okay, at some point in the scene, something really violent is going to happen. When's it going to happen? And it's kind of playing on your mind. But I do think people should be given the chance to say, actually, no, I'm not in a space where I feel comfortable or safe reading that or, engaging with that right now.
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to be, stop everything, turn the lights up, everybody, just before we go into this play, you will see this and it will happen like this at this point. It doesn't have to be like that. Nobody is forcing anybody to hear or read these things. There are plenty of brilliant models that exist out there already that show us how to do these things really well and make them findable but not invasive. I don't think they're ever really invasive. And also, the people that have those arguments, like, I'm pretty sure the same people saying, oh, well, that's a spoiler, would 1,000,000% spoil me on something just to because they want to share it. And I have a friend who loves spoilers because they are content warnings. Because, yeah, like the because that is how they found content warnings for stuff. So they basically don't watch or consume anything without reading the whole thing first, the whole plot or whatever, because that, was not provided in a way that was about enabling people to access stuff safely.
I
So
love that
yeah,
they
I
found a
think
workaround, but it's sad that they've had
exactly.
to.
Yeah, people will find a way, and if they don't, they won't buy your stuff. There's
Exactly.
plenty of stuff I'm like, yeah, that sounds lovely. I'm not going to do it though, because it, StoryGraph says it contains graphic level of X, so that sounds quite harmful to me. And believe it or not, I'd rather have a nice day and have a cup of tea and not have a mental breakdown
Yeah,
than
it's funny
read
that,
this
isn't
book
it?
that you think is nicely written. That's not worth it. It's not worth it.
No, it's not, and I think people don't understand. It's not just the impact at the time, or for like 5 minutes. It can be weeks or months afterwards that you're still dealing with like that particular trigger.
I think that's it. I think it's a fundamental lack of understanding about what it actually means to be affected by a trigger.
So when we find ourselves in these situations where people do the wrong thing or maybe don't necessarily know that they're doing the wrong thing, how do you find it speaking up and kind of encouraging someone to maybe look at things differently?
Oh boy.
That good, huh?
It's so hard. I have to do it a lot because it's partly because in the day job it's like part of our strategy to create a safer, more inclusive space and to be ambitious about that aspect of our work culture. So, it's part of our sort of measured performance in a way. Not that I wasn't doing that already. It's like almost my fault in a way, because I was like, look, I'm the only one doing this. And it's really exhausting because people's reaction to it shows me that I'm the only one telling them this, and I'm the first person telling them this is maybe not okay. And that's exhausting for anybody, let alone if you are one of the people who face the sort of microaggressions or ignorance, whatever that you're calling in. And yeah, there's plenty of ways that you can be sensitive and kind and caring about how you call somebody in. But it is give and take. There's got to be, people have to learn how to respond to being called in as well, because that can really swing it either way. It can be a lovely little experience. There are plenty of people I talk to who it's quite conversational. It's like, oh, I don't know if you know, but so and so has a phobia of that, or oh, by the way, so and so uses these pronouns now, or did you see this resource that was shared with us a while back? This part of it made me think of this. For example, like there's a brilliant video by Khadija Mbowe on digital blackface, and that was shared with me, and it really helped me articulate what that is and what the impact can be, because it can be such an ephemeral sort of thing. And so I think, I don't know, I think the good ways to call in stuff like that is sharing resources and coming from a place of curiosity and kindness. So always starting with a question, and making it a conversation, because you're not just there to educate and to tell somebody off necessarily, because I know this is not always going to be the first conversation like this people have had, especially if you are having to call someone in about something they've done to you or to a group that you are a part of. And it gets harder and harder every time, not gonna lie. It can also get easier, but you kind of, a bit of your soul dies every time you're still hearing those things. And it is work, and it's lifelong work. And I think continuing to do it is it like an act of care to yourself and to the people around you, to the other members of whatever community you're impacted, and to the person that you're calling in, because you're sort of investing in them, I guess. You're like, if you didn't care, if you just were writing them off thinking, well, you're an idiot, you wouldn't bother, you would just avoid. And there are plenty of people who, like, you call in a few times and they don't react well, and you think, okay, this is a pattern, or this is, you know, the door is closed, so that don't waste your energy. I think, like, you have to work with what spoons you have and suss out the context of the environment that you're in and where they're coming from. Like, they might be in a bad place to receive stuff, and that you can sometimes get yourself into a situation that's not great for you either, like having to deal with somebody's bad reaction. I ended up being harassed by somebody once, which came out of a real nothing. And it just, yeah, it, and it was the same message that I'd used with somebody else for the same sort of instance, which in the other conversation was like, oh, right, cool, thanks. And then this other one was a real shitstorm, because some people don't come to that conversation with the same mental stability or good day or learning from before, you know.
I think if there's a willingness to learn or to listen, some people just feel, I think, maybe very insecure or very defensive, and so it can, you don't know what's going to upset them, you know. It could be something really basic, like, as you say, oh, so and so uses these pronouns now, and they'll completely fly off the handle, and you're thinking, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It's not
even, like, this is not even about me. It's not about you.
Yeah,
just use it, them.
But they make it really personal. They take it as a personal insult. And I think you're right. When you're doing the advocacy work, but you're also part of that marginalized community, it's exhausting. And I think you have to look out for yourself, assess whether, you know, as you say, whether that person is coming to this with an openness, or if it is that they're just kind of willingly being ignorant or harmful. And sometimes the best thing to do is just to block and move on, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Oh, people, aren't they fun?
It's a shame, isn't it? It's a shame about people.
It's such a shame about people. The world would be great without people. But also, I mean, no, okay. Also, there are wonderful people out there, which is really lovely, and bless them. So as you say, you've got so many hats that you wear. I'm going to ask you a question and you're going to love it. How does she do it? Can she really have it all?
Most of the time she doesn't. She's sitting at home under blankets thinking, how did I ever do any of this? How does she do it? I would like to room 101 that phrase and put it in the bin forever, because the reason I put this on my form was I find that that sort of attitude comes up in various guises. How does she do it? Can she really have it all? I don't know how you manage. Is it all feeds into, and I'm saying she, because, you know, that is often the context it's set in. I think
Men can obviously have it all, like obviously.
Men and men, obviously. Like a man can do anything. I wish I was a man. Jeez, like life would be so easy. And yeah, there's this like, how could you do that with your tiny woman brain? Like, how could you possibly have managed that with your life as it is, or your body as it is? The whole can she have it all? Like, the fact that that is on the book, the back of so many books, you know, in the blurb, can she
Or films
really
as well,
have a job and a life?
yeah.
Yes, like she has to, because we live under capitalism, thanks very much. And it is a very sexist idea. It's very much directed at poor tiny women pea brains, and also so tied to the disablest idea of you're an inspiration if you can get over all these obstacles. And that is so not just like it's so infuriating for so many reasons. Like, yes, there are obstacles. You put them there. So why don't you take them away, and then I won't have to climb over them?
Exactly. Instead of finding me inspiring for having to struggle
exactly
because of shit you've done,
exactly
do something
don't
to help.
Don't sell me my own pain as a wonderful thing. No, thank you. Just do it differently. Just
exactly.
Make it so that it is not so hard, and make it so that I can have it all. Can have a life and a job and a you know, a boyfriend and a husband and whatever it is that
a whole
whatever
harem.
the all is. Because it's not all, let's be honest. It's not like she's got a yacht and not that I need a yacht, but it's not like she owns loads of stuff. It's that she is juggling life under capitalism. It's such propaganda. It's like, oh, you could have a child and still work, and you could also meet the love of your life while like learning to cook and blogging about. Like, I don't have the spoons for any of this shit, like on its own. So it just feels like massive propaganda to sell you the idea that if you just keep going, and if you just keep trying and putting yourself into the things that you love, but also the things that you have to do because we make you to be able to survive, and you know that you'll overcome things because you're strong and you're doing it, and that's all about your positive attributes. Like, no,
but also fit into these boxes at the same
time.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, you'll never be considered perfect, or what's the word? We'll never actually want to be you. Like, it's not that kind of inspirational. It's not aspirational. It's we're choosing to say that what you're doing is about your strength rather than about the shit that we're throwing at you.
Yeah. It's inspiration porn. They like 100% get off on it, and they feel really good for being like, oh my God, congratulations for making it up the stairs that we've built.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's a guilt, get out of jail, get out of guilt free card. And it can do one.
It can 100% do one. Also, I don't want to do everything. I've realized I've had this wonderful like epiphany this year at the beginning of the year, because my health got so bad last year. Like, just trying to push through stuff and trying to have it all, I suppose. This year I was like, fuck it, I'm going to focus on my health and well-being.
Yeah,
and then I'll
yeah.
see what I've got time for after that. But
yeah,
and it's been like revolutionary, and I'm so lucky that I'm in a privileged position where I've been able to not drive myself into the ground working, and instead focus on like building strength and trying to recover from this stroke. Woo. And it works, and like I hate to say that, because people are like, oh my God, how have you got so much better? Like, it's still shit, but how have you got so much better? And I'm like, it takes money and having spare time, and that is it. And that's why capitalism is fucking all of us, but particularly the disabled people who are trying to do literally anything with their lives but not being able to, because you need so much money to survive in this world, let alone thrive.
Yeah, absolutely.
yeah, that's my little rant of the morning.
Yeah, no, it's exhausting. It's so true. It's really, because I work full time, there are things that I can't do that would serve my body and brain, you know, to a minimal extent, like cook for myself. So my partner does the cooking. And again, I'm so lucky to live with somebody who is willing and able to do that. And there are so many compromises in my day that are about energy. And it does sometimes take until I have some annual leave and just have a day off to A, get sick and feel it and then recover.
Yeah.
Or B, like have the time to actually remember or think about planning to do something fun for myself. It's not just as easy as, oh, make sure you fit in some nice stuff. It's like, yeah, I would love to do that. However, I'm really tired now. Like it's 4 p.m. and I'm done.
I used to do, well, in fact, I still have to, like if I have an event that I really want to go to, I will then block out like the next week to make sure that I can recover from it. And sometimes it takes, you know, weeks or months to recover from something, but I am trying to make more of an effort to do the things that give me a little sense of self or connection or, you know, bit of a mental health boost. But it's so hard to then fit it all in.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't have it all.
Tiny woman and non-binary brain. tiny it's tiny spoons that I find, like it's the tiny spoons. What's your experience of like disablism and sexism within all the different arts things that you do? Is it the case of you're finding a lot of people are like, oh wow, oh gee, that's so impressive that you do all the jobs that you do, or like you're a person with a disability doing this work in this sphere?
I partly am not in that sphere anymore because of microaggressions and also, like, I guess macroaggressions. Like, I left my theatre company several years ago because I was in burnout. Because we'd been trying to have it all, more fool us, three tiny women pea brains, trying to make theatre just for the love of it, but also trying to make it a living so that we could do it at all. And you find out a lot about yourself, and you find out a lot about the people around you when you are trying to make a living off something together. Especially when it's in the arts and it is work that means something to you, especially when you are starting to tell stories that are deeper, more personal, more meaningful, more connected, I guess, to other people's stories as well. So one of the reasons I sort of fell out of love with what I was doing was we were trying to make a piece on an issue, which you should never do. You should never start with an issue. You should always absolutely start with an issue. If it's like this incident happened and it got my blood boiling and I need to tell my story, tell a story, tell a personal experience. But we were starting from the wrong part in that sort of spectrum, timeline, whatever. And it really brought out all the baddies that were lurking under the surface of this dynamic, namely that there was this underlying disablism that I hadn't really realized affected me or the company, or what we were doing. But when I started to struggle with my energy, which was the main thing, when I had burnout and was sort of lapsing into depression again because of that, it suddenly became violently obvious that I couldn't survive in that environment, not with that dynamic, not with those people, or that belief. That it was wild. Like it permeated the work we were doing. despite the work we were doing being about mental health in women. And that let me know I was in the wrong place.
Yeah.
And that maybe it wasn't viable. So I'm not one of these sort of success stories of, you know, she can have it all, because I realized actually, no, I can't do this at all for a while, for a good while. And there are plenty of little ways that, you know, certain people get to you over the course of learning new working relationships in the arts, and plenty of, you know, plenty of little comments that men make, for example, like, just as an example, just plucked out of the ether, don't know where that came from, but it's really hard to pinpoint, but there are lots of little things that happen that let you know you're not supported. So you can, and I have anyway, in my experience, I have sort of removed myself from more and more circles, if you like, for various things that people have said that have really stuck in my teeth, or that have, you know, that have really been quite harmful. So I think in navigating that, for me, the answer is sort of taking time off and just working with the moment, really. I guess that sounds really wanky, but whether you've got the support around you or not, you have to sort of, okay, what is this going to do to me if I keep like bashing my head against this wall? Is it worth it? Is the story, like, is this art piece really worth it? Or do I need to just be in a hole for a while? And that could be, you know, a week, a month, 10 years. Recover, like, find yourself again, and you've got to love it. You've got to, especially if you have, if you live with health conditions that cut down your time and your spoons, you have to spend those spoons wisely.
Really wisely.
You have to really want to use those spoons.
I think it's so, like, being in a hole can be beneficial. And I know that my lesbian friend would be laughing really like so much right now. But spending time in a hole can be really beneficial. I know when I sort of first started doing more performancey things, I kind of like rushed into what I thought was a queer scene. And I didn't really understand the difference between like the queer scene and the gay scene. And I was doing a lot of work in the gay scene, and I was getting a lot of cis men performers who were being quite like deliberately misunderstanding things about gender or pronouns, or you know, it was really quite offensive the way that they spoke about trans and non-binary people, and women, and lots of other stuff, and disability and race, and like, you kind of think, I don't want to, this is so awful. And you can only advocate so much and say, you know, so many things and have so many conversations or arguments before you feel like you're becoming a pariah. And so, taking some time to step back, to get in a hole, and then to look around and be like, oh my God, there's all of these incredible queer people who are making art that is inclusive, that is anti-racist, that is, you know, pro-trans rights, and it's out there. It is out there. There is normally something that you can find that is going to fit you and be a safe space, but you can't just throw yourself at it and waste spoons.
We finally have a Kings and Things night in York, which it's been a long time coming. I've been desperate to investigate because I have a perfect world drag name, which I'll say, but I was like, I haven't seen any drag kings. I haven't been to these shows because there is nothing here. Sort of Yates's drag queens kind of, and I don't want to go to a bar where you can't wear trainers because you might be in a gang and ridiculed by a cis gay man dressed as a woman. Like, that's not what I'm there for. What are they called? I've forgotten the name of the collective now, but King Butch and Spiky Mikey have recently started up an inclusive, a gender inclusive drag night.
I saw, yeah. That's amazing. See, I'm so blessed in London. Like, I will say, I do love drag queens. I love drag in all forms, but it's when it's just there's only, you know, like the one bar that has one drag queen who, like, give us diversity, give us all of it. I want to see it, and I want to see, you know, more drag kings and things on TV as well. Like, for God's sake, it's about time.
And it's hot. Like, they are wasting their opportunity. It is.
Jesus.
I would pay good money, and I do now pay good money to go and see, you know, not just cis gay man in dress. Like, it's so much fun, and it's just so much more interesting. I think I've seen plenty of one type of drag, and I would love to see more of more interesting, more diverse drag.
So political and so creative, and it's just it's such a shame that it hasn't got the recognition that it deserves. But
absolutely,
and role models as well. So I know one of the things you wanted to talk about was, like, you know, not having brilliant role models kind of when you're growing up. Having some role models on the scene, in the clubs, on TV would be really helpful.
Absolutely. Thanks, Section 28. I would really like to finally actually be able to see, hear, say, anything.
And then also people are going to learn. So one of the other things you wanted to say is, like, the invisibility of certain aspects of your life, which I really relate to. Like, I look non-disabled a lot of time, which is amazing when I consider how disabled I feel.
It's wild. I think a lot of people feel very torn about labels, and I definitely am not into, like, binaries, binary labels, but I because to me there is so much more than words, which is gonna sound heathenous given that I'm, you know, all about language, but you know, I think words are about clutching at the sort of cosmos of experience. There's so much more than, you know, this or the other, it is really veiled. I think we live under the veil of a lot of just refusal to see a lot of stuff. I can't even put it into words because it's so pervasive. It's like this refusal to see anything outside of the standard accepted, talked about binary, the advertised binary of everything. It's really invasive. It changes how you think.
They've erected structures, and then they assume that everybody lives within those structures and within those boxes.
Yeah, which sort of squeezes you into those shapes, you know, like.
Yeah. The way that people treat you and respond to you, like, I know I get, it's really jarring. If I go into a queer space and people know that I'm non-binary and disabled and pansexual, whatever, I feel so different to when I go into a cishet space and people treat me like I'm, you know, like a cishet female who's able-bodied, and like it's like so jarring to get that treatment and that behavior and that response, and you're like, whoa. And then you have that decision of, do I comply or do I, like, fight against it or speak up or say something? And then that's really uncomfortable as well.
Yeah, it really is. It's I think expectation of others can really can keep you from yourself, which sounds really obvious, but it can. For example, I struggle with I think a lot of internalized disabledom, and I think part of that comes from never having had anyone in my family who was considered disabled or was labeled disabled, and including myself, like, that's never been a word that was used in our family, and quite possibly because I wasn't visibly, you know, disabled in a way that is understood as disabled. And I still really struggle to connect or to not connect to claim that term. I guess it feels so alien because it's like I haven't been given permission to use it because I haven't, you know, because I'm not in a wheelchair, essentially, that's like the one way that disability looks. It's not, you know, you can't claim being disabled if you have a long-term health condition, whether that's with your body or your brain, even though it could be plenty, for example, like this is taking me down a rabbit hole, but I feel like I am stuck in a rabbit hole of non-labels, because like I've been trying to sort of pursue diagnoses of various physical ills for a while, and part of it is just aging, I'm sure, or not exercising, or you know, you develop little broken bones and things along the way. Like, who knew getting up from a sofa would be so difficult by the end of your 30s? Nobody told me that. I thought old age was like 70 plus, but no. It's there from your mid-20s onwards. So yeah, there's all these things that are sort of floating around me that I've been trying to sort of, it's not like I want them, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not desperate to be, you know, disabled or have these health conditions, but I kind of already have them, I think, and it's like, I would love for you to just confirm what this is so that I can know it, manage it, I can find the things that will support me that are designed for this thing. And it's so difficult to, obviously there's plenty of gaslighting and ignorance within our health system. There's plenty of history of not believing people who are assigned female at birth with their health issues. There's plenty of like lack of investigation into pain management for people assigned female at birth. And for example, like this one thing that I was pursuing a diagnosis for, I had like a certain amount of non-invasive tests. And then the answer was, well, everything looks clear up to this point. You're okay. You're safe with this, this, and this, but it could be this, which is like this life affecting, it's like this crippling health condition. We can't tell you without doing this further super invasive procedure, which would potentially leave you with further long-term pain. I was like, nice. That is a terrible response. That's not an option.
And when the diagnosis it's so important. It is really important, as you say, so that you can name the thing and so you can treat it, but also for other people to understand that it's something that they can hang their hats on, isn't it? And then it goes back to, if you've got more role models, which aren't just, you know, the poster child for disability is someone in a wheelchair. We need to expand the range of disabled people that we see, of queer people that we see, so that we start to break down the, okay, cishet norm, able-bodied is the norm. Let's assume everybody is that way. And then everyone else kind of gets lost or like pushed or shoved around by those assumptions, which is really, it's brutal. It's like literally so brutal on your, like on your soul. That does sound wanky, but.
It is. It really, it keeps you from yourself, from knowing yourself and being able to advocate for yourself. It's really difficult. And I think like you're a brilliant example of somebody who changes that like on the daily, you know. I think it's wonderful to have I don't think previously I've had role models in the arts, especially who, you know, like I'm not going to go near the F word, the high F, low F terms, because they're bullshit. But if people see you looking what they think is non-disabled one day, particularly if you're performing on stage and you're lively or you're able to walk or you're whatever, you have energy, in one tiny moment that they see you, they think, oh wow, that person has, they can do that, I can't. Or if somebody's looking at you who is not, has no health conditions impacting them, they'll think, oh yeah, they can manage, of course they can, they can do all this. And we don't get representation in mainstream of people who have disabilities or health conditions that are occasionally visible. Like maybe sometimes you'll use a mobility aid, or maybe sometimes you just can't leave the house for a bunch of time because you need to recover. So it's really nice to see I don't think in the past I've seen as much or as strong representation of sometimes you can do it, you know, it's this binary if you can or you can't.
It's definitely getting better. And I did a show the other day with a burlesque performer who is fantastic, and they use a walking stick, and they were telling me that they'd done another show with another disabled, like not visibly disabled, kind of like a, you know, like a ninja disabled person. Like I think of this as like, you know, like we're like ninjas, like we can eavesdrop and spy. And this other person was like, oh my God, you can use a walking stick when you're on stage? And this performer was like, yes, you can. You can use whatever mobility aids you want. You can do whatever. You can also put your mobility aid down and then do like some, you know, sexy burlesque dancing. It's all there. And I love that, like, we have this range that's starting to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you have anything that you'd like to share? Do you want to read any of your work?
Sure, I can read you a poem if you like, which was inspired partly by the title of your podcast.
Amazing.
So this, I was interested in the idea of cabinets of curiosities because I was horrified by the Australian bushfires and what we're doing to nature, as we all should be, and was thinking about colonialism, as you do on a nice Sunday afternoon, and looking at P.T. Barnum and all the other long ago pale stale male peeps who put together cabinets of curiosities. And I read this wonderful description by somebody who said of those men who meet inoffensively together. So that's what the poem is called, Who Meet Inoffensively Together. The people in the pool look like glitter from this height. And why wouldn't they, beyond flame's reach? Black cockatoos flock to strip bark, ripping plaster from sarcophagus, sealed up with honey gum. They crack under the weight of decades of yes, the lost best time to act, look up an image of this species and think, how could we? Diminish this bedazzled miniature of reanimated ink, crying at us from nightmares, knowledge of the worst within us. Their yells the most attuned, synchronized to our mistakes, our wrongs, like a baby, innate, not lost, not unnatural, but a rational response, perfectly designed, greeting its purpose. How could we have forgotten this loud night sky, wings as potent as a father's disappointment? Their yelling is then, is now, is tomorrow. Until death do we dare, playing chicken with the undead. Black sleep time yanked down from its place in the atmosphere, made smoke, fed to the day like an experiment in the sink with shampoo. Stirred with glitter and hair, it looks like they are swimming away from something, the heat of curious hands. It is too late to learn trees and birds. Remember the night sky and count the stars you cannot see. The end.
The end. I love that. That was gorgeous. That line that was like, and wings as potent as a father's disappointment was like, oh my God, straight in the heart. That was incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that. Do you have any final words of wisdom for anyone listening?
I do, actually. I have a quote for, I think it's really handy. I can't remember where it came from, but I found it super helpful for my health. Somebody once said to me, we should never be so grateful that we forget what we deserve. And I think those are words to live by.
Wow. That is,
it's hard, like, isn't it?
It's so hard, and it plays into like living in shame as well.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's, yeah. Wow. What a banger. Thank you. Oh my God. And I nearly
you
forgot.
You can have it all.
Tiny brain. I almost forgot. I got to ask you the question that everyone gets asked on this podcast. If you were a mythical creature, what would you be and why?
Oh yes, I love this question. Yay. I would be a goblin because I basically am. I feel for my partner. I think because mostly housebound.
Yeah.
And fascinated with the grotesque, in all that that means, like the theatre of the grotesque, masks, living outside of tradition and expectation, I guess. Yeah, all of that.
I love that. I love that so much. Like I often say to my husband, like I am a, you know, I'm like a filthy little goblin when I'm at home, because I am just very much. Yeah, that is. Yeah, I completely relate. I love it. Thank you. Yeah. Oh wow, Anna Rose, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, you too. Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
Take care.
You too. Thank you.